Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and Fraser Nelson. This morning, a Birmingham prison is dominating headlines. Katie, why is that?
So the Birmingham prison has been taken off G4S, who were privately running it on behalf of the government, and back into government control. And this is following perhaps one of the worst cases of things going wrong in a prison. There are reports that the inmates basically were in control. There were cockroaches, vermin. There was blood on the floor. There were prison inmates openly really taking drugs, things like spice, and just this general feeling of disorder, the idea that officers were sleeping on the job. And it's meant that they're now back with the government and there are calls for an inquiry into how this was allowed to happen.
Fraser, G4S is a private company that was running it. Is this an example of bad privatisation?
It's an example of management's gone wrong, but when you get a private company screwing up, it always gets a lot more attention than if the government does it. For example, we had this with A4E, Welfare to Work Provider, that made a dreadful mistake. And then people are pretty quick to say, see, that's what happens when you privatise. But when you look at the G4S contracts, they do run quite a lot of prisons quite well. Also, government is plenty capable of really bad management decisions. So it's difficult to discern a trend here that the private sector does it worse than government. I mean, I'm not a great, fan for privatising everything. I think I'm a believer in choice in the free market. But as with real companies, if the government gives it to a private company to manage, there is nothing saying it's going to be managed better. The idea is you'd use more innovation and all the rest of it. That's the theory. It doesn't always work in practice. And there isn't such a thing as a competition in running prisons. But I think the government, it hasn't really tried to blame G4S here. It could easily have said, look, what do you expect? We gave it to dodgy contractors. But Rory Stewart, the prisons minister, has said, yeah, this is my responsibility, as well as other contractors. And if anything, Rory Stewart's making his name as the man who's promising to resign in a year if he doesn't make progress. By the way, he's excluded Birmingham from this promise, I noticed. He's saying, yeah, there are 10 prisons where he says he'll resign if there's not progress. Birmingham isn't one of them.
So that's really convenient.
Yeah, but of course it will reopen the private-public question. But I don't really think that G4S's record is so sufficiently bad that you can point to a trend.
And I think people have been quick to point out, perhaps on the more sympathetic to G4S line, that actually, if you look at other prisons run by G4S, they do seem to be improving and have got higher standards in recent inspections. So this isn't across the board all G4S run prisons.
This doesn't, however, take away from the fact that it's absolutely staggering that any organisation, government or private, could allow conditions in these prisons to deteriorate. I think a lot of people will have listened to the news with a sense of complete disbelief that this could happen in a British prison. We've run pieces in the magazine about what happens in some Latin American prisons, pretty scary. But the idea of prison staff being unable to walk through the corridors because the smell of drugs is too overpowering, of locking themselves in their room to escape the violence, and even to have a prisons minister says that he would like less drugs and violence in the prisons, takes for granted now the fact that those two characteristics now define Birmingham and other prisons. So I think this has been a real wake-up call to the country as to how bad prisons have come. We ran a leading article in The Spectator about 18 months ago, predicting prison unrest and, I guess, more prison riots. That hasn't happened. The riots haven't happened, but the underlying causes, you've got prison staff who aren't paid very much. In fact, their wages are staggeringly low when you think of what they've got to endure. And you have a place, an area of government where cuts are very much to blame. I'm not saying entirely to blame because bad management's a factor, but the government has really shredded the prison's budget for a long, long time, and I think we can begin to see the results of that.
And Katie, what has the government done about this prison now?
So it's back in government control now. I don't think you technically call it nationalisation. I think there's a way that you describe it because it's something in the contracts which means that you can shift without having to use what would be a bit of a difficult buzzword for Corbyn team. So now they've got back control. There are people saying there should be an inquiry into this, but the government side is thinks that this actually wouldn't be helpful, and the focus really should be just on straight away improving the situation rather than going and soul searching as to how you got there.
They also intend to give it back to G4S once they've finished taking it into therapy, as it were. So, you know, it doesn't seem to be a longer term. And also, I can't help thinking that we know about Birmingham, but what about the prisons we don't know about? How bad is it in other places? It's difficult to believe that Birmingham is the only place where disorder of this extent is reigning.
And in other news, it seems that the government is preparing to make EU nationals an unilateral offer to stay in the UK, even in the event of a no-deal Brexit. Fraser, do you welcome this proposal?
Well, this is what The Spectator called for, like, the week after Brexit. It was the most important thing. We said it's time to make a unilateral, unconditional offer. And it is, I have to say, a bit galling reading the press. Stephen Swinford of The Telegraph has got the story. He's got the first what would happen in no-deal detail. And one of the things that would happen in no deal is this unilateral offer. And there's a quote saying this would give us the moral high ground. Well, yes, it would, but it would have done that exactly the day after Brexit as well. And everybody who campaigned for Brexit also campaigned in giving immediate assurance to all EU nationals. Nigel Farage was up for doing that. The only people that weren't were Remainers, who understandably were arguing, look, it will give insecurity with EU nationals. And then Theresa May was the only person who thought it should be implemented. So she did. She implemented this system of where you put the skids under 3 million EU nationals. So yes, it would be a good idea, but it would have been a good idea 2 years ago, and I can't believe the government still hasn't done it.
Well, this is part of the government's around 70 to 80 no-deal technical notices that we're going to get as of a big load dumped, I think, on Thursday, and then more as we, you know, over the next few weeks. And the whole point of them is to try and give advice to businesses, citizens, public bodies, and basically actually make it ease concerns about what they would need to do in the event of a no-deal Brexit. I think, although this is a long time coming, this is a good example of a positive one, which actually should ease concerns. I think it will be interesting as the weeks go on to see how these all land, because there are concerns on some sides that the technical notices, which are meant to be very dry, could actually make people more panicked, and the government could be accused of, you know, playing up problems, project fear, rather than being helpful.
Fraser, can we expect the EU to reciprocate for British nationals in Europe?
Well, it's already said that it would do. We said that several months ago, but I can't work out why they still haven't managed to agree it. I mean, of course, the official line is nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. But that still uses EU nationals as bargaining chips in a way which is morally indefensible and always has been morally indefensible. This was the first of the major mistakes Theresa May made over Brexit, the failure to say on her first day in the job that every EU national in the country would be welcome for as long as they wanted to stay. It denied her the moral high ground. It was a strategic blunder, and unfortunately followed up by several other strategic blunders.
And last, Katie, hard Brexiteers are rallying as Aaron Banks' Leave.eu is urging supporters to join the Conservative Party. Why are they doing this?
So there's been a little bit of outrage over the weekend from the more Remain side of the Conservative Party after Leave EU, which is the was a non-official campaign group for the EU referendum, which was associated much more with the UKIP side. Nigel Farage attached himself to that vehicle, has used its social media following, which is very large, to place these posts suggesting that everyone who supports Leave EU and a true Brexit should join the Tory party. That's not because there's going to be a leadership contest tomorrow, but because there will be one, they believe, you know, soonish, and you have to have been a member for a certain number of, you know, weeks, months before you're allowed to vote in it and you're eligible. This has been accused of UKIP entryism on some sides. I think obviously there's some people who don't like it, because people like Anna Soubry would not want someone like Boris Johnson to be leader, or Jacob Rees-Mogg, and these are the two candidates that Leave EU would prefer if they were going to get a true Brexiteer. But I do think if you look at the way politics works these days and how momentum has been a vehicle to Labour, to me it seems a bit narrow-minded to think that you could stop something like this. I think grassroots movements are, you know, they're able to flourish now because of social media and things like that. And although you might not like some of the people who are joining, surely that just means that you should encourage more of your supporters to join rather than try and stamp something out, which is pretty unstoppable.
This is actually the second batch of the stories we've had. A few months ago, we had talk of Remainers trying to join the Conservative Party to make sure they could steer the leadership campaign. And now we're having the other way around. it's quite easy to laugh at this kind of tactic and think, how could this possibly work? But then again, we wouldn't have Jeremy Corbyn as leader of a Labour Party if this didn't work. So there is a logic to it. You need to be a Tory member for 3 months before you can vote. We're probably at least 3 months away from a leadership election. I think that's safe to say. But the big question is, would the sort of Remainers or even Believers be as kind of digitally dexterous as the Corbynistas? I think Jeremy Corbyn was able to draw on this fairly large diaspora of people off the far left who are in the habit of going into chat rooms, of clicking on petitions and things, who spend a lot of their time joining things that each other suggest. I'm not quite sure that either the Brexiteers or the Remainers are in that habit. I mean, we're in the period now where anything can happen in politics, and I don't see why an infiltration of the Conservative Party ought not to be one of those unlikely things. The big question is, who's going to do the infiltrating?
Thanks, Katie. Thanks, Fraser. And that was it for today's Coffee House Shots. If you liked it, do subscribe, rate, and review us on the iTunes Store. And we have a subscription offer. Get a free thermal insulated Spectator water bottle when you subscribe for just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk/water. Thanks for listening.